Oh, hey. Let me put my phone away here. You know, I'm doing what everybody does. Glued to the phone, texting and everything. When was the last time that you've actually put your phone aside and not answered it, or not sent a text message or replied to a text? Because I know that you guys are out there when the phone does ring. Sometimes you look and say, don't want to answer it because I see who it is. So yeah, there are times that we avoid those calls. I do it, you do it, we all do it. Hey, so today's podcast is with Sunny Blaze. I love that name, Sunny Blaze. He's going to talk a little bit about his life, growing up, working in the fields, going and becoming a jeweler, kind of like a jeweler to the stars. And we get more specifically into diamonds. So I'm going to say this is Diamonds Are Forever, because they really are. But we also talk a little bit about the man-made diamonds. So what are the differences and things like that? And we go as far as talking about if you're getting married or there's a special occasion, what should you look for in these jewelers or custom pieces of jewelry that you're going to have made? So I hope you enjoy this. Remember, jewelry is really good, especially if you're giving it to your girlfriend or wife. I think it keeps them happy. So have a listen. Please like, share, comment. All of that really helps whatever algorithm is out there. Well, there you go. You see? That one says it's from TikTok. So I better go check it out. And you guys, please stick around. Check this out. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I'm Sunny Blaze. And I am from farm country. My dad was a sheep shearer. I sheared when I was a kid, high school and in the summertime and the weekends, and making me the fourth generation sheep shearer. My dad's from Texas, so our family is part of Texas before it was Texas. So we come from a long line of farm workers. When there wasn't any shearing, we'd work in the fields over summertime. But going from farm work to diamonds, it's a strange transition. I know it's not something you normally would hear, but I've incorporated a lot of different things in my life to get where I'm at. So let's just talk about for a second my upbringing. Being a farm worker and being in small country, I grew up in a town called Bethune, Colorado, population 183, I think was the last census, eastern Colorado out by Kansas. The part of Colorado that doesn't look like Colorado, it's all flat lands of cornfields. As a matter of fact, if you listen to REO Speedwagon's Riding the Storm Out, he's, I think in the live version, he's talking about like, yeah, we're driving through Colorado and it's still flat lands until we get to the Rockies. Anyway, getting into the, out of that farm country was something I really wanted to do at a young age. I started playing guitar, you know, after that REO Speedwagon concert in the early 80s. And I was like, you know what, I want to join a band. And so I knew I didn't belong in the farm country. I moved to Denver. And that's how I left farm country and ended up in the city.
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting where music really gets a lot of people to make their move, so it's...
Yeah. Yeah, you know, for me, it wasn't really a desire to be a rock star. It wasn't really a desire to be, it's just something that I loved. I love music, and so I love playing, and being in a town of 183, I was in a graduating class of 9, so it wasn't like we had the smallest school in Colorado, actually, literally. We were threatened to be closed if we went under 99 students from kindergarten to high school. And no, it wasn't one room schoolhouse, but it was multiple rooms, but it was incredibly small. And so there was a series of culture shocks as I went into my future. And we'll talk more about that. But really, just get to the upbringing, we were very poor. So we, you know, sheep shearing was few and far between. So, you know, we didn't always have as much work as we wanted to. My parents, my dad hates to hear this, but wasn't the best financial manager. So we had what we needed. We had love, we had each other, we had food, but we always had to find our way. And migrating from Texas all the way up to South Dakota, Colorado being the home base, we would travel quite a bit to find the sheep shearing ranches where we needed to be. And so it was quite often that I'd find myself in like South Dakota for the springtime, maybe Texas in the summertime, but worst possible time to be in Texas because it was so hot. And in wintertime, you'd be in Colorado, worst possible time being in Colorado when we're having blizzards. But, you know, somehow it just worked out that way. But we learned from those things. You know, these are these things that actually help us to grow into the people that we are, these lessons that we learn along the road. But then the next chapter was then getting into jewelry. I actually moved to Denver in 1990. 1990 to 91, I was kind of doing odds and ends. I joined a band, and we did pretty well for about a year or so. But I needed work. Every musician needs a job, right? It's like, seems like the one thing that's missing in there is we need a job. So I actually was talking to my drummer, and he says, "Hey, you need a job?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, coincidentally, I'm a musician. I need a job." Drummer's mother was a co-owner of a jewelry and watch repair company. And so she said, "All you have to do is deliver jewelry to the malls. We repair jewelry and we repair it and deliver it and pick it up." And so my job was basically just to deliver and pick up jewelry repairs at the mall. And so that was how I got into jewelry.
Well, from that point even to where you are now, that's a huge leap. But, I mean, this is really coming from, like, Little House on the Prairie type of situation.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's, yeah, and you've moved to the big city. So once you got into the jewelry business, and we'll even include you as a jewelry delivery guy.
Yeah.
What was it that kept you there? Because if you got into that way back then, you were pretty young.
Well, it was the girls.
Okay. Yeah. But wait, they're coming in there with their fiancés, right? To get wedding rings. What do you mean?
Well, here's the thing. Actually, yeah. It's not necessarily entirely the truth. I loved to draw since I was probably 5-6 years old. I love artistry, being a musician, being an artist. I've always had a core part of my soul being into artistry. And so, I knew nothing about jewelry when I started. I didn't know the difference between a sapphire and a ruby, really. I just like blue, yellow, red, whatever. And so I was just like, you know, this is really interesting, but I love the artistry behind it. I started to learn and appreciate the artistry behind jewelry. So at the beginning, it was just kind of fun, and I was kind of buying time. I was like, you know what? I have a job. Let me just do my job, enjoy my time with the people I'm meeting. And yes, I was meeting actually not the girls that were the customers. I was meeting the girls behind the counter that were actually selling jewelry. And
okay.
A lot of these girls were the single ones, you know? So they were the ones that were, you know, more available. And honestly, I didn't date a whole ton of them. It was just nice to walk in because they're used to seeing couples and guy and women all the time. But at the time I had really long hair, when this long hair dude would walk in and be like, "Hey, what's up?" It was kind of fun. And so they loved to see me come in, and I would love the interaction. So we had some great relationships. So we'd have friendships. And so that kind of kept me going. But in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, I want to be a graphic designer, maybe an architect. But the whole idea of going to school was still kind of like financially a difficult challenge. And secondly, it was kind of like, well, how do I go there? What kind of job do I want? And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So it kind of just got complacent, which is kind of a really bad word that you got to remember in your life. You get complacent, you get kind of stuck where you are. And I kind of got stuck there. I was enjoying my life, but I knew at the same time, I was kind of just spinning my wheels. And so I was playing in bands and I was kind of finding my way, and I was just kind of just coasting along. And that's kind of what made me stay.
Are you self-taught, or did you go to school to learn design?
Yeah, a little bit of self-taught. A lot of self-taught, a lot of hands-on. Traditionally in the jewelry industry, and this is actually changing, I would say the last couple decades has been significant change in the way the jewelry industry kind of trains people. Traditionally, a lot of families will hand that over, hand that down as a tradition in terms of jewelry industry. Like if you're a diamond person, for example, a lot of people will come from diamond families. Designers are legacy jewelers. They come from people, their parents were in the jewelry industry. Their parents owned the jewelry store. I had a sheep shearing dad, so I had to find my way. So yes, I did actually, I had to find my own way, but again, I was kind of stuck in a little bit of a, I was just kind of stuck in this route. But the pivotal moment in my life was a woman, my wife now. we got engaged. And when we were talking, I was probably about 10 years into the jewelry industry. And at this point, I had learned a lot about watch repair, learned about customer service, learned a lot about diamonds, a lot of hands-on experience on what jewelry is about, but not any formal training. And so what had happened is that her and I had a conversation. She says, why don't you get more advanced training? You're so into it that you should really get more trained. And so my first thought is I want to be a diamond specialist and a appraiser, because I can make a ton of money being an appraiser. And I love the science behind jewelry. I was really debating between the design, the science behind gemology, which is the study of gemstones, and then the watchmaking, because watchmaking was really cool, very scientific, a lot of engineering and the tiny gears and everything. And I said, you know what? I think I would do better as a gemologist being a diamond specialist. So we went to New York. So we go to New York and I study at the GIA, which is the Gemological Institute of America. And that is the foremost authority in gemology, which is where probably most gemologists, particularly in the US and a lot of international students actually, there's a main campus in New York and a main campus in Carlsbad, the headquarters in Carlsbad, California. And so the students come from all over to train, because GIA actually standardized the diamond grading system, which is basically, when I say G color, D to Z color grade, if I say it's a flawless, or if I say it's a SI1 clarity, or if I say it's a cut brilliant, the four C's as we know it was basically established by GIA. So what they did is they established a standardized system for diamonds so that people could actually trade them in good conscience and saying, okay, well, what's the trade value? What's the quality standard of this diamond so we can regulate it so people aren't getting ripped off, people aren't getting, setting their own standards all over the place. And we'll get to that later about lab-grown diamonds, because that's a whole nother thing that kind of is right hot right now. So I got some retail experience to understand the value of jewelry. And then I moved back to New York, because I left New York after training and went to Denver, got some retail experience, and then went back to New York and worked for the GIA laboratory, where I got to see, the most unbelievable diamonds in the world. I got to be like just within a couple of feet of the third largest diamond in the world, the incomparable. I got to grade 50 carat intense yellow diamonds. I got to grade red diamonds. And now when I say fancy colored diamonds that are like the multicolored stones, multicolored diamonds, I should say, this is actually a very small segment of the diamond industry. And I actually was one of about 20 people. This is at that time. This is in the early 2000s. I was one of about 20 people in the world that had the opportunity to actually grade these colors. And getting into that part of it was about a 3-6 month training, a testing process. You go through all these tests to make sure that your eyes are qualified to actually discern between what's red, what's pinkish red, what's purplish red. And these subtleties in color are insane. So I went through this intense testing before I could be authorized, and I was luckily blessed enough to be part of this elite team of Fancy Colors. So here now, take a moment. I'm at GIA, New York, looking at the most valuable diamonds. I mean, even invaluable. I mean, priceless pieces of specimens of mineral. And in the city, I was living in Manhattan, and I'm thinking back, gosh, I grew up in farm country, graduating class of 9. As a matter of fact, my whole family was homeless in Nebraska Park for like a week or two, trying to find a place to live between work. We're, you know, we were migrating to find work as a child and as a teen. So to flash back from that to where I was just overwhelming.
So let's fast forward to, like you said earlier, about real minerals, real diamonds, real stones, compared to what is, you know, the recent trend, I'm going to say, of over the past 10 years, probably a little bit longer, is man-made, yes. Man-made diamonds. Or just take diamonds as an example, and just throw in the mix, because the colored diamonds, yellow diamonds, you know, there was a time, I think, when people were growing up, you think diamonds and all you think about is clarity. How did the man-made diamonds affect the jewelry industry, the real diamond industry? Because you had your VVS, your VV1, all your grading and things like that. So what did it change? What happened?
Well, this is a really interesting component, and actually it's really, really important in our industry right now. It's probably one of the hottest topics and hottest, this is one of the hottest years, I should say, in our transition in the way we market. So basically, to sum it up, lab-grown diamonds, the Federal Trade Commission has actually been talking about how to regulate and how to properly disclose what we're talking about when we talk about lab-grown diamonds. They said the terms we need to use is lab-grown diamonds or lab-created diamonds or Sunny Blaze created. I don't create diamonds, but just use say laboratory name created diamonds. Because what it is, it's a synthetic diamond. And but I want to get some myths out of the way here really quick, because we're actually in a win-win situation right now in the industry, which is a low-cost product that a jeweler can make some profit on. So the jewelers are getting making money. The customers are getting a great product that's real. So the first myth is that diamonds that are lab-grown are real, genuine diamonds. That's the first important thing to remember. The quality is phenomenal. You're getting D color, G, F color, which is basically in the colorless range, VVS, VS clarities, which means there's virtually nothing you can really see inside, even with magnification, very difficult to see. And you're getting them, now they're finally, the technology is getting into large sizes, so you can actually get into a bigger diamond a significantly bigger diamond for the same price as you would in a really small natural. Now, these are all really great positive things, because it also, the environmental background behind lab-grown diamonds, you're actually in a laboratory-controlled environment where you're creating this diamond. And so you're not digging a massive hole in the ground, you're not using children and other, you know, people to dig up to mine these things and creating or even funding civil wars and other things like the blood diamonds. Now, I am just saying this on the wind side, but I have to say that there is another side to that. And I'm not going to be doom and gloom, but people need to understand the absolute truth behind this. So the lab-grown diamonds are actually, to sum that part up, exactly the same as their natural counterpart. Physically, optically, they're exactly the same material. It's crystallized carbon. You won't be able to tell the difference as you look at them. They're going to look exactly the same, which is why the Federal Trade Commission and other industries are starting to regulate and say you have to disclose, because you have to tell the customer. It's actually required. You have to tell the customer this is a lab-grown diamond, because the average customer is not going to be able to tell at all. They're going to see this gorgeous diamond and be like, wow, that's amazing, and that's a great price. I got to have that. It's a lab-grown, and so we're in a win-win situation. But here's the flip side.
You get into the flip side, I want to make sure that we disclose and people understand, because I'm going to go with back in the day here, cubic zirconia. And yes, we want to make sure that people know that it's not that, you know, it's not a piece of plastic. It's not, you know, an acrylic thing made into looking like a diamond. Like I said, for all intents and purposes, laboratory created diamonds are, can I say, exact replica of a real diamond? Or is replica the wrong word?
I don't think replica would be an appropriate word to use necessarily, because it actually is a real diamond. It's not even a replica. It's the real diamond. I want to actually point out to you, thank you for bringing that up, because there's actually two words that you want to really remember. They're synthetic and simulant. Synthetic means that something is actually the same thing, but it's just made by man. A simulant is like a GGG, which is a garnet, whatever, blah, blah, blah. It's clear. A CZ, cubic zirconia, a synthetic moissanite. There's all these, like glass, you cut it into like a shape of a diamond. These all look like a diamond. They're called simulants. Simulants are just basically stones that look like a diamond. Synthetics are actually real diamonds. And this actually applies to any gemstone. We see a lot of synthetic lab-grown sapphires, lab-grown emeralds, and other things like this that exist in the trade. And typically those aren't as big of a deal, because people already know. It's like, well, they've already been informed this is a lab-grown or a synthetic or a CZ or a glass stone. And so there's definitely some key terms to really think about. But for all intents and purposes, a lab-grown diamond is a real diamond.
And then, like you said, that there are some negative sides to the lab-grown. There are the positives, like say we're not digging holes, we're not putting, I'll say to children, you know, out there laboring away, we're not destroying the environment. So those are the benefits that we are not doing those, but then there are some downsides to lab created.
Yeah, we're gonna kind of this is just to be in full disclosure, because I am in favor of people, you know. When people want something of good quality, they want to go with a lab-grown diamond, that's okay. I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but there is a couple of challenges to think about. Number one is the lab-grown diamond, and I'm going to just try to be as diplomatic about this as possible, because a lab-grown diamond is kind of like printing money, okay? You can make them as many as your manufacturing can produce, which kind of creates a concern about the value of the product, because this is my favorite analogy, if it maybe makes sense to people. Okay, we have to remember why we buy diamonds, because it's beautiful and because it's something special. So, for example, think about it this way: if we had, and we're going to suspend reality for a second when we think about like Jurassic Park and like dinosaur bones and all this other stuff, reproducing something from way back. Let's just say we had the technology, we kind of almost do already, the technology to make a dinosaur bone, and we actually simulate it. It looks and tests and exactly like a real dinosaur bone. You made it last week. By next month, you'll have 1,000 of them lined up. They all look exactly the same. They're all genuine dinosaur bones because they're made and tested and physically, optically, exactly the same as a dinosaur bone. So now you distribute all these dinosaur bones around the world in various museums. And you say, now someone can go up and see what a real dinosaur bone look like. And it's like, wow, that's really cool. But there's this one museum somewhere that has the one dinosaur bone that was actually found a billion years ago, whatever it was, you know, and that dinosaur bone is in the museum. And you ask yourself, which museum is going to get the most traction? Oh, I saw the one that was dug up that's a billion years old. This bone is a billion years old. You got to go see it. It's unbelievable. Oh, I saw the one over there at the other one. My neighbor actually has one at his house that he bought on eBay. It's exact same thing. Like, well, is it really? I mean, you know, that's where the question comes in.
Right.
Because, you know, if I can print 1,000 of these diamonds, where's the value? And so that's where the big concern is right now in the industry. It's just right now we're in a win-win situation, but as the prices are plummeting, it makes you questions like, well, where's the value in this? And so it is going to be sentimental. It is going to be important. It is going to be long lasting in everything a diamond is, but the value is going to be something that we have to keep an eye on. And so that's one of the big things. Now, the other thing I want to talk about is the natural versus lab-grown industry. Keep in mind that to simulate the lab, the diamond manufacturing versus diamond growth in the earth, this is high pressure, high temperature environments that we're talking about. So we're not talking about popping some carbon in the microwave and it's done. We're talking about equipment that consumes a massive amount of energy. To give you an example, say like right about the average lab grown diamond consumes about 1,000 kilowatt hours of power per carat to create versus a natural diamond consumes about 7 kilowatt hours to actually mine. Now, even though the consumption of power is significantly different, there's still the big massive hole in the ground. But where does the power come from? We're going to have to mine this coal and power coal. A lot of these diamonds are actually made. Right now, 46 or 43%, I'll forget the stat exactly, 43 or 46% of all the lab-grown diamonds are actually coming from China. So they're not actually using renewable energy sources to power this manufacturing process. They're actually using coal or other sources, which actually can, again, 20 major diamond mines in the world, and there's 4,000 plus coal mines in the world. So if you want to talk about a big hole in the ground, the coal mine being used to create these lab-grown diamonds far exceeds the number of holes we've created for diamonds. So you're talking about the environmental impact, we have to think about that. And I know this is kind of a stretch. At the end of the day, the diamonds still have a much lower impact environmentally than the natural diamonds. But I just want to point that out to be fair to the natural diamond industry. And then finally, with the kids, there's a lot of stories like this. And I grew up in the farm country. I was out there in the fields. My dad is going to be upset when I say this. He's like, oh, don't tell people that you worked as a kid, you know, because this whole, you know, not exactly the best parenting. You know, growing up as a Mexican American, our culture, and in a lot of cultures in the world, the entire family contributes to the household. And so even as children, we are just raised to work and pitch in because we're all poor and we want to make sure that the family provides for itself. And as children, we all pitch in. And so when you have this 12-year-old, 15-year-old child in, say, the Republic of Congo, who's out there digging for diamonds, he can't quit that job and go to work at Subway. There's no job there for him other than that. And the family sometimes, say the father or the mother or the grandparents, are just not in health where they can work. So they rely. If that child does not go to work, they don't eat, period. And I want to say lastly that bad governing in these countries is not the fault of the diamond industry. And so that is why there's so many regulations. The Kimberley process, there's other councils around the world that have actually stepped in and say, listen, we are not going to support these countries if they're not going to treat their people well, or at least reasonable. As an example, at the outset of the, Biden's administration, when he came in, Russia provided America with 30% of the diamonds we consume. People don't always know that. Well, we actually banned diamonds from Russia after they got into this confrontation with Ukraine. Say, listen, if you're going to, a part of what we had to do was, like, we're not buying diamonds from Russia anymore. And so that kind of put a strain on natural diamond prices because we're no longer getting them from Russia. And so we had to get them elsewhere. And now lab-growns came in. And so there was a ton of factors going into it. So the people are definitely being more conscious about how can we provide natural diamonds at a great, responsible background. And so I'm sorry, long answer, but that is kind of where we're at with how we talk about diamonds versus natural diamonds versus lab grown diamonds.
You know, it's very similar to fossil fuel versus EV, you know?
Right. Exactly.
You've got the mining, you've got the very, very similar situation.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, if we're flooding the market, I'm just going to use the term flooding the market with these lab grown diamonds, which are real diamonds. Mm-hmm. And if it brings the value down, it seems like the natural progression is kind of like what you have going on at sunnyblaze.com, where design really comes into play. Does that, the value, not only is it in, you know, the stone looks great, but oh my gosh, look at that ring, that design, look at that pendant. Is that helping because of all this new technology that you're able to incorporate into the design?
Yes, it's very important to talk about to our consumers. It's very important. I want to reemphasize to all the listeners out there that you need to have a good conversation with your jeweler when you're making a massive decision like this, investing a lot of money. Talk to someone you really trust, or work with a company that you have faith in, or you have trust, or has good reviews, or has good report, because, you know, you want to make sure you get all the right answers. There's certain terms like bespoke and couture that are really important when you're shopping for something very unique, because it's basically designed. It basically means that it's a piece that's designed as a one of a kind. It's a piece that's designed specifically for a person or a purpose. And so you're not getting a cookie cutter piece that's been sold a million times. I love to create jewelry that's going to be just yours. In fact, a lot of designs, I started to kind of put more generic terms like the hermosa and like the these names in my designs, but for a long time, I had a name for it. Like this ring I made was the Kelly. This new one made the Hoang because it was specifically made for a person. That's bespoke. Mm-hmm. That's couture. That's custom. When some people will tell you, we do custom work, and they gave, this is the head, this is the shank, and you put them together. That's not custom. That's assembly. Custom bespoke right. is not assembly. It is actually completely ground up, unique, and custom. And that's why that's where my focus is. And that's what I really cherish and most proud about in my design work, is really being able to offer something that's essentially one of a kind. Amazing people doing amazing things. You gotta love it.
Thank you.
Well, hey, there you have it. That is really the end of part one. We've got a second part to this. So part one really just focused on Sonny's life, growing up in the fields, and then working his way up into becoming this jeweler. So I hope you enjoyed that part. I hope you also enjoyed the part that where we talked about the natural, real diamonds compared to the man-made diamonds. It really opened my eyes up to understanding a little bit more about what the man-made versus the natural diamonds are. So in part two, though, that'll be coming up later, probably around springtime, so I know that's a ways away, but watch for that, where we talk about what it is that you need to look for when you are looking for that specific jeweler that's going to help you out and to help guide you into making your right decision for this big, big decision of yours that you have to make. So again, please like, share, comment, and if you have a suggestion of a show, please let me know about that in the comments or give me a call. Until next time, enjoy your day. Thanks. Bye-bye.